Accession number 27813, Mr. Jack Ray, Reel 2. Now, we're talking about your time at Malta from April 1942, when you first arrived, and you've been shot down in your first flight almost. Not a good start there for you, although lucky that you survived, I suspect, from the sound of things. Now, what happened after? When something like that happened, were you given a couple of days off, or was it very much get back on the horse? And
I had a problem for a while because, of course, the cannon shell that crashed into the aircraft actually it blasted into the back of my leg. And I was always thankful that, what I had never realized, that our flying boots, being sheepskin lined, actually were quite a bulletproof. And it was amazing the amount of cannon shell that was held up inside the boot itself, and only some penetrated my leg. And so I had to have a bout in hospital. Because of our poor diet and general conditions, it took a long while to heal. That's sort of gave me the problem, the darn thing. So they had to leave it in a plaster for a while. And even when I finally started flying again, I still had the leg in a bit of a plaster. It just wouldn't heal up. But the fascinating thing was that while I was there, no doubt you've guessed, because from being an NCO, as a rank of a warrant officer at that period, I always had a bad thing about hospitals, because I never liked the discipline of the British hospitals as an NCO, because the first thing they want to do is to take away your uniform, take away your clothes, and give you a prison garb that you... The idea being, of course, they wouldn't clear out of the hospital, of course, and attack your personal gear. And I said, no way, I'm not going to give you, and I won't give you my camera, and I won't give you my uniform. And I started to have one hell of a battle with the ward sister, who happened to be a sergeant, one rank below me at the time, and so I was trying to throw him a rank at this fellow. And of course, you could imagine a whole ward full of people all just with their mouths open looking at this battle that I had no show of winning. I knew that finally, because I was pretty ill at that time, and I was getting dizzy with the M&B, which was the only thing they used to feed you with antibiotics with. And I'm standing there thinking, boy, I'm not going to win this battle. And then all of a sudden, there was a trampling at the side of the ward, and in came about a half a dozen military with a sergeant leading them, and they came up to my bed and stood, clicked his attention, saluted me and said, excuse me, sir, your commission has come through and we've come to move you to an officer's hospital. You couldn't believe the stunned victory I had out of that was quite amazing, because when I arrived at this other ward, I had a room to myself, I had a lovely fridge with a piece with a bottle of beer sitting inside of it, all the luxury I could wish for, and I couldn't believe this change of attitude. I had the ward sister came to see me, the colonel came to see me, and I was welcomed generally. And then the next thing they came in, and there was a military fellow, he said, do you mind if I bring in a German prisoner to meet you? I said, no, I don't mind. So anyway, he brought in this fellow, and this young German officer came in, clicked his heels, and good talk, and then he said, we started to talk, and I discovered he was a blighter that shot me down. Quite incredible. By the time I checked with him, sure enough, I was his number 13 victory. He shot down 13 before he was shot down. Lieutenant Herbert Sukup was his name.
Herbert?
Herbert Sukup. Yes, Sukup, I think. He was a Czechoslovakian, Sudeten Czech. Quite a nice chap himself. And of course, he thought it was one hell of a joke, because he knew why I'd got shot down, and he had deliberately set his number two to trail behind us, knowing he'd recognised, he was shrewd enough to see that this was a pretty amateur-looking group that was flying around, and he sent this chap in as a stooge. And he exactly what he knew. What happened is, when I reported this aircraft behind, the other three all had a look at him, and nobody looked at my tail at all. So I was just bare and exposed.
Now, how long were you actually in hospital for? About?
Just about a month, I suppose. So I started operations again in June.
Now, operations, which squadron had you been put in by then?
I went into 249 squadron then.
Now, tell me about how come you were put in 249 squadron, because you were meant to be in 603. Now, what was the cause of this change?
Mainly my friends. I had there were two New Zealanders, and particularly a New Zealand, an Australian. There was a chap called Ray Heslin, and a New Zealander, and Paul Brennan, an Australian, were two that are particularly close friends. And I just liked their general atmosphere. They were swashbuckling, great squadron, and I was thrilled to get asked to join them.
And you joined as an officer?
Yeah, and I joined them as an officer, yes.
A flying officer?
Pilot officer. Yes.
Now, can you describe the squadron to me? Who were the key personnel? I mean, traditional to start with. Would it be a squadron leader commanding, or did they have a wing commander?
Well, the one that, of course, I got to know well was Laddie Lucas, a well-known British golf player, of course, but Laddie was a magnificent fellow. And he just took the squadron over soon after I joined.
Now, he'd be, what was he, a group captain or a...
Squadron leader.
He was just a squadron leader.
But all
what was he like? Because that's what we're into. Because I mean, there's things about him.
He was a great leader. That was his greatest attribute. He had a great personality and very pleasant, and he was concerned with his men. Excellent. We had a good cross section of all sorts of types. We had Canadians like Buck McNair. They were great fighter pilots. But Laddie had something rather special going for him, and had a lot of time for Laddie.
And he'd fly as well, would he?
Oh yes, definitely.
And so, who were the others? Who were the other key people?
Screwball Burley, of course. They were Canadian. He was the top ace. Screwball Burley, yes. We called him a screwball. He used to sort of take the wings off flies and things and put them into the sand. He used to do funny things and stamp his foot on them. He's a brilliant pilot, and he was gifted with eyesight better than any of us. Quite incredible. We used to stand at Mdina when we weren't flying and watch formations coming over, and the Maltese had brilliant sight. They used to start counting these fighters coming over and attacking long before I could see them. But Burling, when he came and stood beside us, he was sharper than the Maltese. He started telling us how many were in the formations, where they were, out of the blaze of blue. He could see them. And later when I flew and had Burling flying with me, he inevitably saw the aircraft before you did. He was just gifted with that sight. And he was a brilliant pilot as well.
Now, you made him sound slightly weird, this business from the inside.
Yes, he was.
I mean, was he? I mean, not particularly nice weird.
He was a likeable screwball. He hurt his parents, entirely, because his parents were very religious. And he had a few sort of broad comments about, as any swashbuckling go to, and hurt his parents a little bit. But... he was killed later. He's flying for the Israeli, you know, after the war.
But you liked him.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Now, who else? What about your friends? Ray
Heslin, Paul Brennan.
Now, yes. What about them? Ray Heslin. Why was he so particularly your chum? What was he like?
I think it was mainly that we were a little bit anti at that time. Let's get this straight without hurting anyone. A little bit anti-British of some of the sort of officer class of it. And had our own sort of outlook on some things, and Ray was very successful as a fighter pilot, and we just enjoyed each other's company.
And Paul Brennan,
he was another one, an Australian, a straight talking sort of fellow.
They were the two you particularly. Any other real characters? Bit difficult. They'll probably crop up as we go.
Yes, so. They're hard to sort of pull back at this stage, but there were a lot of them.
Now, what would you say the role of the unit was? It's pretty obvious in one way what it was, but how would you define what you were trying to do with 249 Squadron, what the squadron was trying to do?
Make it costly for the Luftwaffe to bomb Malta. That was the prime objective. In other words, we tried to break through a lot of their fighters to their bombers. In other words, we were a defensive role.
So it was your priority to shoot down the bombers, not the fighters?
That was our first priority. But obviously, in many cases, you had to fight the fighters before you could get into them. Because we were always hemmed. There was one big advantage fighting over your own territory. If you got shot down, you did return again. There was one huge disadvantage that you had to try and land when you were out of fuel and nowhere to go. And of course, the Luftwaffe knew that. And just about the time that they knew you'd be running out of fuel, another wave of fighters used to come over Malta to stop your landing. and you had no ammunition left in your guns, you had no fuel, and you were trapped into trying to get down. And the only chance you had was the defence of your Beaufort guns and the boys on the ground.
I think one thing it might be useful to do is to look at a typical squad sortie, you know, when you went up on a thing. Really going right from the very start and then looking at everything about that I can think of and you can think of that could go. So how would you know? I mean, would it normally start with a scramble? I mean, is that, or would you know? Was it
usually the phone would ring, and at the moment the chap would be running out of the shed, firing off a red light, very pistol, and we were halfway to our aircraft all in that 1 second. The moment that phone rang, just about.
Now, so where would you wait? I mean, did you have like the Battle of Britain, this idea you have somewhere where you're drinking coffee and, you know, and hanging around waiting?
No, we were just sitting in what was left of a derelict hut. You must remember everything was bombed and wrecked in that place, but we'd be sitting in a sort of desultory matter waiting. And
what would you be wearing? Would you be in full kit?
Yeah, in full kit. Well, yes, just about full kit. We knew we were going to go any time because the control used to ring and say there's a formation building up over Sicily. So they knew that there was something building up, and it was just a matter of it won't be long. And then you just waited for the moment, and then you'd get into your aircraft sometimes.
Now, what exactly were you wearing? From
some of them wore shorts. I didn't. I used to wear just a khaki kit, just khaki shirts and khaki pants. That's all.
And what about flying? Your flying.
And of course, your flying gear.
Now, what was your flying gear?
The helmet, speaker, of course.
So it had the intercom in.
Just used to wear silk gloves usually, not the big heavy ones, just the interlined gloves. And that we'd just sit there, and if we're on.
And that was it?
And
no other. Oh, your flying boots, you mentioned.
Yeah, and of course, in full readiness, sometimes you sat in your aircraft and sweated, you know, because not for very long, so you were ready to take off.
Now, so when you got the scramble warning, the fire, you know, you actually scrambled, what would you do? Run to the aircraft?
Run or be in it. And of course, the ground crew, the motor's starting, it's going, and you're off.
So when had the checks been made on the aircraft? That had all been done before?
Yes, we had to trust our crew. We didn't have time to
do anything. So it's not a matter of checking?
No, that routine. It's just open the throttle and off.
So it was an immediate takeoff. Was there any order of taking off, or did you take off
formation? Oh, yes, flight leader, preferably, yes. You'd form up using pairs and flights and off and scramble and form in formation just above. You must remember the drone wasn't wide enough. In Britain we used to take off in flights and formation, but in Malta with bomb holes everywhere, two aircraft, there was no room for more than two at a time.
Now, what were the flying characteristics of the Spitfire? Which mark did you have?
We had the Mark 5C.
Now, take me right through. What was it like to fly? And we'll perhaps look at even the controls and instruments, if you can remember.
The Mark 5C, of course, they made a big mistake with initially. We brought them out with four cannons. They were far too heavy on the controls, and your arms would ache with trying to control the ailerons in them. So we ripped out two of the cannons. So they became really the same as the Mark 5. And, of course, as far as I'm concerned, the Spitfire, we always did regard it as a perfect lady. It had no vices. It was a beautiful machine.
And what was so good about it, looking back?
You could hamstring it. You could do the most incredible bad flying with it, and it would forgive you. It really was. It was a fabulous thing to fly. And you could maneuver it. You could fight in it. And it just did not let you down.
Enough speed, enough maneuverability.
Speed, it had sufficient speed. We were equal and slightly better than the 109. We had to be a little careful, funny enough, of the Italians. Occasionally the Italian aircraft had very similar performances to the Spit. Actually, the Reggiani and the Mackies, the Germans started putting Daimler-Benz engines in them, and they had quite a high performance. But the thing that we had to remember, they didn't have their heart in the fighting, and they tended not to be very aggressive.
I'll come back to that. Now, what about the controls? What controls did you have in the cockpit, as you remember it?
Turn and bank indicator, pressure, just the basics. There's no fancy bits, really. The compass, of course, and the gyro compass.
Nothing fancy at all?
Nothing special, no.
Just joystick and the usual controls. And what you say, would you say made a good Spitfire pilot? I mean, what qualities were needed to be a good pilot? I mean, it would let you off if you were a pretty dodgy pilot, but what would make you an actual good pilot, Spitfire pilot?
I think he had to be a good pilot with the controls. We used to joke about the ham-fisted boys and so on, but no. The most successful pilot was a good pilot. He respected his aircraft, he flew well, and he did all the basics right.
So you'd do better if you were a good pilot?
Yes, there's this sort of ham-fisted, poor pilot. He's not a good fighter pilot or any other pilot. No, your machine, you've got to respect it, really.
Now, when you took off and you formed up, what about this business of formation? By this time, what formations would you have dropped? Would it always be the line abreast?
Yes, line abreast or finger four.
Not the V?
No. No, it's not a V. It's virtually practically line abreast. Just a slight finger four.
And you always adopted that?
Yes.
And did you find that that met with what you want? I mean, was that adequate? I mean, you'd had all the awful problems with the line of stern.
In an experienced group, yes. You were much more aggressive because you were flying faster. That's one thing. So you're operating faster. You were more secure because you were actually looking at that piece of sky and you knew that somebody equally experienced was looking at your piece of sky.
Now, tell me about one of the things in the First World War was that aces or anybody else had to keep a very good look around, that all this business
That's
about
right.
wearing silk
yeah.
scarves
yeah.
to stop your neck rubbing.
Yeah.
How did you look around the sky? I mean,
well, we always say that the most fatal thing to do is to try and look at too much at once. You have to take a piece of sky and look at it, and another piece and look at it. In other words, if you just kept on spinning your head around in a panic, you didn't see anything. You had to literally look carefully at each piece of sky.
And so would you do it in sections, that bit like
yes.
that?
That's the way I would do it. That's the way we did it. But of course, occasionally, if we were uneasy, we might switch and do a little bit the other side. We didn't.
So it wasn't entirely. There was a sort of logical basis,
yeah.
but your instinct would
yeah,
also. You'd have
right.
another look. Even
yeah.
if you'd only just done it, you might have another look.
And of course, you're going to look much more up sun, of course, because that's where they'll be.
Now that's another old First
yeah.
World War thing. Was that still the case? They'd come out of the
Beware of the Hun of the Sun. Yes, that was the basic. It was there all the time.
Was it difficult to look into the sun for long periods?
Yes, it is.
Or even short periods.
Yeah. It's amazing how you do sort of see just that tiny speck or flick or a flash from a wing. You know, you just get a warning. Because the next thing they're on you, you know, it happens very fast.
I mean, was there a way of doing it without, because you know if you look into the sun playing cricket.
You put your thumb, it's just sort of.
That's how you did it?
Yeah.
And you're looking round, you had your area of sky to look at, which wasn't a bit behind you, someone else was looking at it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. You looked at some of it, but only you looked at his. And he looked at yours, then you were having a good sight at it, yes. It was a much more secure situation.
And much more and trust in your fellow pilot.
Yeah, and, of course, you weren't whirling your head. You're really seeing that part, you know.
What about what they used to call air vision? Because there used to be stories of people would take people up and the new person wouldn't see anything.
That's right.
And whereas an experienced pilot, not even with such good eyesight sometimes,
yeah.
would see loads of things.
You're
was
right.
there such a thing as air vision?
I don't think so. I think it was being not panicking, not looking, trying to take too much in at once. So I think it was just casually looking around piece by piece by piece as you looked.
So the ones who didn't see anything, it's not that there's any special thing.
No, it was a panic look.
It's just they were going
yeah.
looking round and round
and
in a loop
and seeing
and not
absolutely
seeing
nothing.
Anything.
That's right.
You take off, you form up in a light. Do you gain height before you form the formation, or do you form the formation as quickly as possible?
Pretty quickly.
And what flight would you go to? I mean, or was it just you'd go to just above the target?
We were depending on our controller to a lot.
Now, explain to me how the controller thing worked. You had a controller on the ground.
Yeah.
Tell me how all that
worked. We had the gift in Malta of having one of the most magnificent controllers you could ever wish to have. His name was Woody Woodhall, Group Captain Woodhall. He was actually a controller also in the Battle of Britain from Tangier. But we trusted him implicitly. He was a magnificent tactician, and he would watch the formations coming. He would anticipate them. He'd plan them, and he'd vector you to the best advantage position that he could get you. And we trusted him entirely. And he used to come over with such a lovely, calm voice. He'd say, I've got a big party coming over with you boys. And some big boys and some swans. Don't let the big ones get away. Just settle you in your cockpit. He was fabulous.
Now, what would he be trying to do? Get you into a position where you were above and coming out of the sun?
That's right.
From the bomber and fighter formation.
That's what he was trying to do. And, of course, you've got German controllers over Sicily watching us climb, don't forget. And, of course, they're talking to them and hearing what he said. So we had what they call the Y service, in which they're quickly listening to each other's intercom. And they would know in a few split seconds if we had seen them and were about to attack, or vice versa. And Woody would be interpreting what he heard from his group. He'd scream out, "Look out, boys, they've seen you attacking," or something. You know, he would nurse us as well.
So he would be all the time. He's like playing a game of chess almost.
Yes, he was.
And you were the pawns.
That's right. We were the pawns in his movements.
And he'd be all the time trying to get this advantage of coming out of the sun from somewhere where they hadn't seen you, so that you could.
And of course, a smart boy in Sicily is trying to do the reverse.
Now. So what height would you be operating at? I mean,
most of the time we didn't. One of the problems we had, we were trapped in a peculiar problems in the early part of the combat, in that because of our fuel shortage of problems, and shortage of aircraft, we used to sit in our aircraft and know that the whole raid was halfway to Malta before we took off, because if they scrambled us too soon, we would be out of fuel when they sent the next wave in, and we would then be caught without fuel and not being able to land. So Woody had to scramble some early, but hold back most of us as late as he could, which put us in a slight disadvantage. Sometimes when we were taking off, there were some fighter boys right over the top watching our dust trails as we took off, and they would start attacking us from the moment we got off, unfortunately, at times.
Which would make it incredibly difficult.
Yeah, but those were bad conditions, but we were trapped into the fact that at times, if we didn't leave it till the last minute to get off, we got hell afterwards, because then we were just out of fuel and couldn't land, and they were just sending in waves.
Height was still very important, though.
Yes.
Was it? I mean, it had been crucial in the previous war. I mean, was height still regarded as something...
Absolutely. Still vital.
I mean, there was this thing of always above, seldom at the same level, never below.
Yeah.
Still the motto?
It's still applied.
Even with the new aircraft and more powerful engines, height was still...
Yeah. It doesn't matter how powerful and fast you are, that fellow that's diving is going to be slightly faster, isn't he?
Now, so you take off in your formation. Now, what would typically happen? I mean, so you're taking off, you know you're being told by Woodall... would you be maintaining strict wireless WT, or whatever, whichever, intercom?
Yes, we weren't so worried about wireless keeping quiet, but you didn't want to overtax, because if somebody's nattering while there's an important warning or something, you're going to hold up the airwaves. But no, we just carried out normal control pattern. And
what would you do? This is a sort of typical sortie.
You sort of hear or just call as bandits 10 o'clock above. There'd be another bandits o'clock, and so on. And the chaps are commenting what they've seen, and of course, but Woody would be just saying there are further bandits arriving, and so on. And by that time, you're starting to get a picture of the whole thing. And you've got to try and judge when is the right time to dive in, because you know there's going to be some of them on your tail the moment you do.
Now, so when you were outnumbered like this, was the policy to keep the formation together, hit one German group and then perhaps go and get another one, rather than split up and try and take them all on?
Something we were trapped with, as a matter of fact. We tried to keep together as much as we could, but I'd say that 50% of the times that we fought in Malta, we finished up alone.
just through pressure of German numbers.
Eventually, we'd go in formations. We'd get our initial, and that's when we did the most damage. And then it was a matter of survival.
So, the formation would be four of you?
Usually, there's four when we could. Quite often, just two.
So you'd go in, and then almost in the dog. Did their dog fight much? What was the intention, to shoot someone down before they could see you?
Yes, of course.
Rather than get engaged in.
We had one big advantage over a lot of those, you must remember. When we'd tack into these big formations, we knew they were all enemies and they couldn't find us. We were so there was only a few of us amongst them, if you can follow. But.
So which one would you pick if you were, you know, you're attacking a group? Was it the tail end Charlie you'd look for, or did you have more sophisticated tactics?
No, because they were. Well, you must remember they were all line abreast. Those boys, there wasn't too many tail end Charlies.
Sorry, but you stragglers. I mean, really.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, would you try and attack someone who's on their own, or would you try and break up the main German formation? And if where would you attack? The wings or the middle, or?
Well, they'd expect us. We were expected to try and break up the formations if we could. With an effective attack, and then pick the stragglers after that is what we would do.
And how do you break up a formation? I mean, do you dive in the middle of it?
Dive into amongst them, yeah.
From out of the sun.
And then, and of course then all hell gets let loose, as you can imagine.
Now, give us a feeling of what would happen in that. I believe it's almost impossible to describe, so I've got sympathy for being asked this. what is it like when you've broken up the formation? You've dived down, you would pick a target?
Well, of course, yes, you'd pick one of them, obviously, yes, and you're trying to line up. And the moment that you start lining up, you know that you've only got a few seconds because something's going to be lining up in you in another split second. So you open fire and break away again, usually down for speed, and then climb up somewhere else. If you climb up just there, you're too vulnerable, you know. So you
dive away.
Yes, while you've got maximum speed, and it'd be difficult for anyone
straight
to catch
you. Straight or zigzagging?
No, I don't think I did too much zigzagging.
That's right, just zoom.
Yeah.
Dive,
yes.
And then zoom. Would you know what you'd hit, or could you tell whether an aircraft was going down? Did you have time to look to see?
Quite often we didn't even stop to look. Funny, in Malta we didn't. It was an awful lot, but we attacked and shot down. We knew we'd hit, but you couldn't make a claim. You had no time to watch. Sometimes you did know. Sometimes the ACAC boys saw it, and of course the report came later. But
now, there's always controversy about claims. I'm not saying anything, but in the First World War, they reckon it was about 1 in 3 of the Allied claims were real.
I think it's turned out to about the same, I think, now, isn't it?
And there's no. Is that just because of the confusion? It's not any.
I think it's genuine. Genuine effort to tell exactly what happened, but unable to give the final conclusion. I mean, you can describe that you saw flashes and you knew that you'd hit the aircraft and you saw it smoking and going down, but you didn't see it hit. You haven't had time to stop and watch for that, because by that time you know there's somebody on your tail. And so quite often you'd never even claimed. Well, a policy I adopted a lot was claim those as damaged, because you had no idea whether you'd destroyed them or not. Sometimes you'd get a surprise, you'd claim the damage, and later it'd come back from a ground staff or the ACAC boys had seen it go down and reported. So then you'd give it as a destroyed, but that was the little bit of the unusual.